What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye! What up, meepsters? I'm Ryan Rainbro, and this is the Meep Meep Podcast, the show about albums released on Roadrunner Records, or as I used to say when I was younger, albums. Did you ever say that? Someone would be like, oh, go show me that photo album. And I'd say, yeah, that sounds like the right word. But I was wrong, and so were they. What are other words I said wrong? Maple for maple, maple brown sugar, maple brown sugar oatmeal. And I think those are the only two words I've ever said incorrectly in my entire life. But today we're going to be talking about two words, elephant gun. And that might be the third word, because I never confirmed with our guest today, Sean Dennis, that it's actually elephant gun. Because I don't think they're even allowed to have guns in Australia, where the band is from. It might be elephant goon, which I believe is the Japanese word for crew, like Suzuki goon in New Japan Pro Wrestling. And Japan, not far away from Australia, you'll note if you look on a flat map of the earth. But today we're talking to Sean Dennis. We once again go down under to Australia with Elephant Gun or Goon and their debut EP on Roadrunner Records. They released after only 3 shows, which is 3 more than bands play today. But back in the 90s, because this was 98, you had to play a couple shows to put out a record. Now, you don't even need to be a band. You don't even need to be a human. And I'm not just saying that you can be an animal, which you can. Caninus was a band fronted by a pit bull puppy. Hatebeak was a band fronted by a bird. But you can be artificially intelligent, which most people are, because very few genuinely intelligent people. But you're going to hear 2 genuinely intelligent people talk today. That's me, Ryan Rainbro, and Sean Dennis of Elephant Gun. And, you know, we're going to go over some of our favorite elephants. We got the one Ray Romano voices in Ice Age. Top tier elephant. That little rascal in The Jungle Book who's marching away. And Dumbo. Elephant ears at the fair. Often with a little powdered sugar and chocolate sauce. So these are all things to keep in mind as you're listening to Sean Dennis tell us about getting signed to Roadrunner Records, making their debut EP, which we go over in detail, and also the follow-up full-length on Roadrunner, Albino. So be thinking of your favorite guns and goons for after the show, but for now, I bring you my conversation with Sean Dennis.
It's weird because the Australian bands didn't really make it out of Australia. Like, no one really broke it that well to become, you know, or, you know, like, it was a bit of a, the Australian office was set up, the Australian bands worked within Australia, and that was kind of it. And, you know, I think, you know, probably a couple of copies of the albums ended up abroad, but nothing was really broke it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so I guess that's the first thing we should talk about. So the other band from Australia that I've spoken with is Non-Intentional Lifeform. Yeah. And they were from Perth, which I know is just a completely other part of the world in Australia compared to... So that's how out of the way it is. So you're kind of in Melbourne. Melbourne. Yeah, that's how I would say it. Melbourne. There's an extra U in there. You're kind of more in the thick of, you know, where entertainment would be in Australia. So, or how long from when you started the band did you end up on Roadrunner with the EP that came out in 98? Like, how did the band even start? What were the ambitions?
So three of us are actually from Adelaide. So myself, Simon, the drummer, and Mick, the guitarist, are all Adelaide-based and moved to Melbourne early 90s for music. And Todd is from Country Victoria, the singer-guitarist. And everybody else was in bands previously, but Elephant Gun was my first band. But I used to work for a lot of bands, doing photos, drinking their beers, you know, doing lights, you know, just dog's body stuff. And so Mick had a bit of a clear vision of this thing that he wanted to do, and he wanted me to play bass with him, even though I didn't play bass. I didn't own a bass, you know. It was just like, yeah, okay, let's start something up. But he'd seen Todd's old band a few times and just thought that his voice was just phenomenal. And so he had a real, like, I'm going to get that guy to be in my band, you know, headhunting kind of thing. And Simon, the drummer, used to play in a band that I used to roadie for called The Egg, who were awesome. And Roadrunner was actually looking at them, I think, probably in 95, 94, which is one of the ways that John Satterley came to see us. Because someone had told him about Todd's voice and then had told us, oh, this guy John Satterley's coming, and I'd met him through an Egg thing, and I said, I'll tell him that there's some dudes from the Egg involved. So all of a sudden he was like, this band I like, this voice that I've... And so that's how the Roadrunner connection started. But we started the band, wrote some songs. Let me think, it's kind of weird. Our first ever gig, we flew to a friend's festival and played with like NoFX and all these other bands. And like, it was, you know, we were so raw, and we weren't called Elephant Gun. We actually had to change the name when the Roadrunner thing happened, because they were like, the original name might piss some people off. It was called Indian Giver, which here is someone that gives something and then takes it back. But obviously it's insensitive to certain people, and we thought, yeah, okay, cool. So we came up with Elephant Gun. But yeah, so we played our first show in Adelaide with a friend's festival. And then a friend of ours' band was doing a residency at a hotel called the Barleycorn Hotel in Collingwood, which was like a full dive, you know, you step over people in hallways. Our third show was the one that Satterley turned up to, and we got offered the deal after that. So we got signed really, really early. Like, I didn't even own any gear. Like, I had a stolen Pink Yamaha bass, you know, and that was it. And away we went.
Wow. So your third show, that's not only crazy, but also interesting, because I think that's a similar thing with Non-Intentional Life Form, where I don't think that they had played very many shows before he signed them. So maybe, do you think John, well, not do you think, what was the conversation you had with John? Like, what was his vision for what Elephant Gun was going to do for the label?
Well, he really liked the first sort of impression of what we did, but also recognized that it's extremely raw. You know, it's like early incarnation of something that he saw potential in. And he obviously was sort of keen to develop it rather than sort of throw us in the deep end. So as much as we, oh no, that's right. So yeah, he was interested, but I think at that stage he had to get approval from Case. So what they did is we signed a demo contract, did a demo at this studio called Cloudburst Studios with a guy called Michael Pollard, who was our live mixer. Oh, no, he wasn't there. Sorry, he became our live mixer. So he was the engineer at Cloudburst, and we did, I think, like a 9-track demo, which they then sent off to Roadrunner headquarters and got the approval to offer the deal.
So even though you had only had 3 shows, you had 9 songs already? I mean, that's a pretty significant catalog already.
Yeah, we kind of, because the other guys had played in bands before, and I had a really kind of, I don't know, I just didn't want to go out and play and be really shit at the start. You know, I sort of thought we did like, I think, probably 6 to 8 months of songwriting and real intensive rehearsal. So when we came out, we were probably a bit more developed than the average new band who rehearsed for a week and when we've got a show. We kind of spent a lot of time rehearsing and perfecting, or what we thought was perfecting. as we got as good as we could get before we exposed ourselves to our peers and friends.
Well, that's smart and impressive to have that foresight, because a lot of times people just want to get out and play, so they don't worry about that, like, you know, having that appearance. But people forget too that, you know, first impressions can last. And, you know, if somebody sees Elephant Gun, Indian Giver the first time and it sucks, then they may not give it a second time. So that's good.
I mean, but yeah, we were really surprised that it kind of happened so quickly once we, for example, the band that we were playing with on the residencies, we'd been friends with for years, and they were a great band and they didn't have a record deal. And so, you know, we're sort of turned up with, you know, like the original Odd Bunch and just odds and sods. And then like three shows later, we're, you know, talking to an international record label, and I could see, why did we get these idiots on? They could have been ours, you know. I mean, we're still great friends with them, but it was just interesting, you know. And I think that's one of the reasons why we, like a lot of people go, why don't you, you know, do some more work and see what else, see who else came to the party. But I was like, I know bands that have been playing for 10 years that have never had a record company turn up to their shows, let alone ask them to do something. So we're very excited that when Roadrunner wanted to chat, you know, because I was like a big fan of the label, not so much like not a fanatic, but, you know, I was well aware of who they were and what they did, and, you know, had Roadrunner records in my collection. So it was like when I knew who I was dealing with, you know, it's like, this is exciting.
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at rootsmusicrambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
And so since you were aware of the label and it sounds like the bands on the roster, you must have known that Elephant Gun didn't really sound like anything on the label.
And so did everyone else once we started playing. Everyone was like, you guys aren't metal. It's like, yeah, we never said we were. But and that was kind of interesting as well at the start, because a lot of the ways that the label started to try and market the product was a bit more metal than we would like, you know. They sort of wanted to do logos and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And we're like, no, we're just like, we're sort of showing the, you know, that kind of grunge influence. And we like the way that Soundgarden looked and marketed their stuff, or, you know, Tool and whatnot. And, you know, they'd sort of go, yeah, you know, you need to do this. I'm like, no, that's what you guys do on all your metal stuff, and we're not metal. So that was, not that it was ever a problem, but we just sort of had a very clear vision that wasn't traditional Roadrunner, I guess. People come up to us and go, I grabbed your album because it was on Roadrunner. It's not metal. Like, no, it's not, you know?
Well, it definitely isn't metal, but at the same time, I want to give even more acknowledgement to the fact that, you know, there was lots of bands on Roadrunner that weren't metal, but Elephant Gun still doesn't sound like anything else on it. Almost has like this, I don't know if post-grunge is the right, but you mentioned Soundgarden, which I know are grunge, but, you know, it has this very 90s, almost like radio rock feel to it that's reminiscent of the, you know, like maybe like a Candlebox or something like that. Are those kind of the bands that you guys were maybe influenced by?
Yeah, we had like a really broad influence of music. Like, we listened to a lot of metal, you know, we loved stuff like Pantera and Slayer, and then we'd listen to all that, you know, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, the sort of grunge era. But then we'd go back and we listened to a lot of Australian pub rock like Cold Chisel and Midnight Oil. You know, we love Jeff Buckley's Grace, you know, and then we'd listen to hip hop. I don't know, we kind of liked everything. And then I think we'd kind of start writing songs and go, well, this is heavier than normal for us. And so that's when, you know, when they were doing a Roadrunner sampler, they'd kind of put the heaviest Elephant Gun song on it. And that's where I think people go, fuck, they're pretty heavy. And then they'd listen to it, the rest of the album, and go, I don't know what this is, because, you know, there'd be ballads and piano and, you know, not that, I mean, to me, it's pretty much traditional rock and roll. Like, if somebody says to me, what are you guys? I'm like, we're a rock and roll band, you know. But we were definitely heavily influenced by the early 90s. I'd say post-grunge would be a great way to describe it.
And were there other bands in Australia at the time that were kind of more well-known that had a similar sound? I mean, of course, I know Silverchair, but they are even a little bit more grungy, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the music industry in that whole 90s was very healthy in Australia. Like, you could go see a great band every night of the week. You know, you could just go to the Punters Club, go to the Evelyn, Prince of Wales, the SV. And it was the same in Sydney, the same in Brisbane, and the same in Adelaide. Yeah, it was just thriving. And there was such a variety of bands. And you could go watch a lineup with, like, a weird hip-hop rock thing with scratching, like a real kind of obvious grunge band, a punk band. You know, it was just like, it was just really cool with the amount of variation that you could go and see. And, you know, someone playing piano solo with like a death metal band after them, you know, it was just like, they're almost like, it was a bit lawless and no rules. It's just like, everyone was just in to have a good time.
Well, with how kind of green you guys were going into making that 9-song demo, did any of the songs from that demo end up on this EP, or did any of them change dramatically but kind of started off on that?
Yeah, so probably, I'll have to, from memory, I reckon maybe 3 of the 9 went on to the, I think there's 5 or 6 track EP. But funnily enough, the song that John was most into didn't make it on the EP, because we figured, oh, if he likes it that much, we'll hold out, because that way we'll definitely get the album. You know, just like, oh. And then it never made the album. It was a song called Sirens, which was kind of big, kind of stadium rocky, you know, kind of sing-along thing that it definitely was a sound that we strayed further from. It was kind of like our first sound, and we never kind of did it again. Kind of matured away from it a bit after we got our legs on, I guess. But, so there's probably 3 tracks that went onto the self-titled EP, and then we probably wrote another 2 or 3, whatever it was. I think it was 6 tracks. I think Someone Else's Money, or SEM, was one of the ones from the demo. Leading up to making the EP with Michael Pollard again at Cloudburst, we sort of went back to the same studio but spent more time and got a bit more, I mean, when I say more time, we've always recorded completely live in the studio. Like, we don't sort of multi-track. It's like we set up to play live, and I guess that's one of our benefits, because we're pretty tight when we get going, that we can kind of do things quickly. Like, the actual album, the Albino album, was recorded and mixed in 10 days. And it was weird. It was kind of like, we didn't have the budget to do a massive production. So it was like, Cal Yu, the producer, had this concept where it was like, first day, we'll record a song and mix it, and that's that song finished. Second day, we'll record a song and mix it, and that's that song finished. And we did that for 10 days straight. And that's the Albino album.
Wow, that's a really interesting approach, but it must have also felt very organic too, like you didn't overthink it.
Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, once it's captured, you know, because obviously if you're tracking and then mixing, you can kind of go back and drop in other tracks if you need them, but we were very much like, that's done. And I mean, I think it had its pros and cons, but I kind of dug it because the dudes producing and engineering it were like, this is kind of wild, you know. And I was like, yeah, this is wild. But I was just like, but they were doing like something completely different. You know, like, I don't think it's a very done way to do things. You know, it was like, so literally from start to finish, 10 days. And then obviously it went off and got mastered.
We'll be back after a quick break.
You still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. and you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah,
know what I mean.
So do your homies got a role in your little? You mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man.
Y'all
trying,
already?
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm trying to get them on there. Yeah, we all artists, man. We go. You feel me? We gonna have this like.
Bro, me and my man Kyle, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gonna lie, we play with this shit right now for real.
Don't play with it. Don't play with it. Take that shit serious.
Well, not to dwell on this fact too much, but I think it's a very fascinating and important part of the band that if you guys had been so young as a band, you know, before you got signed, before you made the EP. And you even kind of mentioned that John Satterley, the guy that signed you, saw potential, untapped potential there because you were raw, as you said. What were the kind of points of input that maybe the producer or John were coming in with saying like, hey, you know, I really like what you guys are doing here, but maybe we should try this or that?
Yeah. So from John's point of view, I perceived he saw that there was like a bit of raw potential there, which needed to be worked on and tidied up, which then they would basically finance rehearsal. Like we rehearsed a lot and played a lot. Like we were touring and playing nonstop. So I think their way of going, you're going to get better the more you do this. So they just made us do it a lot. Like, you know, we pretty much... like I remember I was working at a record store, and then when we signed the deal, I like walked in. I'm like, I quit. I got a record deal. You know, I'm going to have to go off and tour and stuff. And like my boss was like, who's a really good friend of mine still, and he actually mastered our most recent album, the Now to Survive album. He's like, all right, you do know that half the people that work here have record deals. You know, it's like, and I'm like, nah, I'm going to go, you know, touring and, you know. It was just like the most dumb thing I could have done, walking out the door, you know, from financial security. Because obviously once you become a musician, you're broke for a long, long, long time.
Yeah, and definitely. You never stop being broke as long as you're playing music.
Exactly. And, when we did the Albino album, because we only had that 10 days, I think it was maybe 7 or 10 days, we went to a rehearsal room with Cal, you, the producer, and played for like 12 hours straight. So we did a lot of pre-production to make sure that 10 days would work, because obviously we're doing it a bit skew-iff. So a lot of rearrange, not a lot, but there were sort of songs that he would go, like that chorus doesn't sound like a chorus. That should be like a middle eight or a bridge, and you could rewrite something a bit catchier or whatnot. And so... it was very much a collaboration with him in that sort of 7-day period before the album where we got to know each other. And, he really drove us hard, which I think brought out the best in us, because up until that point we hadn't had much direction or, we'd kind of done our own thing. But to have somebody go, that's really bad, you know, you need to fix that or we're not going to do it in the studio. And we're like, oh, okay. And you had to actually work to make it. You know, there were songs that he was like, we're not recording that. There's no way. And there were some that he's like, that is good. We need to work on it. But yeah, there's, out of the 10 on Albino, I reckon 6 kind of stayed as they were, and maybe 2 or 3 got really sort of reproduced, you know, sort of produced by him and made them way better. That song Cliche, which is, it started off as a massive rock song, and when we got into the studio he was like, let's do it acoustics, piano, all sit around a circle live, and it's like this sort of backwards cello on it, and it sounds like something, you know, it doesn't, it's sort of like a acoustic country kind of redneck foot stomping. I don't know, but I remember just going into the studio with Cliche is a massive rock song and walking out with this polar opposite going, what happened, you know? Well, I'm happy with it. It's a great song, but it was like, And we've actually got the heavy version on a B-side of something, so you can sort of see the contrast. But, yeah, it was pretty crazy. Like, that 10 days, it was a great time, but it was, you know, it was really, we got dropped in the deep end, and it's like expensive studio, bloody, you know, producers and engineers running around everywhere. Not a lot of them. You know, there's like Richard Stoltz and Calu, but we thought we knew a lot, and we were kind of like, we don't know anything.
And what was the idea of putting out the EP first? Was it just so you would have something to immediately start playing shows off of?
I think they knew that we weren't album ready. Like, you've got a couple of good songs, and if we put out a couple of good songs and the rest is filler, you know, it's just going to be an average album. So the EP was a way to get something on the market, something to radio, something for us to promote on the road. So, yeah, I think it was just an easier, cheaper alternative rather than dropping a bundle on trying to do an album straight away, knowing that we weren't ready for that.
And was there a song on the EP that you guys did send to radio?
There was a song called SEM, which we did a film clip for, which I cannot find anywhere. A good friend of ours, Colin Renshaw, did this film clip. He was working at like a TV studio thing. And so that got sent to Rage and all the sort of video, you know, like MTV options. And that got played on the radio a bit. But I think like they didn't really service it as a single as such. I think they kind of just sent it out because it had quite a bit of variety on it as well for an EP, just to see what would stick maybe. And that could have been more them going, this is the direction we should go in. But, you know, out of those six songs, everyone I speak to has a favorite. So there wasn't like a clear cut, this is the way we should be doing it, you know. So like the first song, Our Cold Hour, I think we wrote that one in the studio. And yeah, that's probably my favorite on the album.
Yeah, SCM and then Monster are kind of the more like driving, high energy songs on it. So that would make sense to me that they would think like, oh, okay, this is the one we'll try to. And when you say film clip, that's like music video. That's what in Australia they call a music video.
Yeah, film clip. Yeah, our music video, which we didn't do too many. Like, we had maybe four or five video clips, film clips, music videos. But like, we never really had the budget to do it the way we wanted to. So like, because I mean, it got to a point, especially in that late 90s, early 2000s, you know, like people were making big money making music videos. And, you know, they'd go, we've got like $7,000. And we'd call around and you could literally get your uncle with a handy cam, or, you know, you ring the professionals and you're like, we've got $7,000. And they'd go, you know, sorry, we can't even provide lunch for that, you know. And I was like, what? You know, so our video clip, film clip, music video, like, I sort of look back on them and go, oh, they're just not very good. But it doesn't matter, you know, it's just a bonus. I'd much rather have a good album than a good video clip, you know. It's I think listening is more important than seeing, even though I do love a good music video when you see them. But yeah, we didn't have the money to compete and make what we ordinarily would have done.
And so you mentioned early on too that a big drawing point of the band was Todd's voice.
Yes.
So was that something that you guys spent a lot of time on as a band, like kind of coming up with the vocal arrangements or the lyrics, the songs, you know, because that's kind of the focal point you're saying as far as what people liked about it?
Like, yeah, I'm a big fan of Todd as well as, you know, being a band member. And like, he just has this natural ability to write lyrics, sing like a demon. Like, we'd come in with a riff and by the third time we're playing it, he's got like a full song of lyrics over the top, complicated content, you know, harmonies going on. And I was just like, well, you know, and when we first started, he would only sing, but he's an amazing guitarist. But then we bought in. So I think on the EP, he might've played on one or two songs. And then by the album, he was playing on every song, bar Battery, I think. So the more we sort of got confident and comfortable with each other, the more the two guitar thing came in. And when I see him doing these Chris Cornell-like vocals and ripping on the guitar, it's like one person doing two people's jobs really well, and I'm struggling doing my one-person job, you know? Yeah, so he's a natural.
Were there some notable shows or bands you played with that stick out to you from these days?
It's weird because we didn't – when we eventually – because we end up leaving the label rather than breaking up or getting dropped, we got to a point where we were sort of touring a lot and, you know, financially destitute, personal relationships were breaking down, girlfriends were leaving, couldn't go back to that job, they were sick of us. So we really did the hard yards, and the results probably weren't there, you know, and we were sort of saying to them, what are we going to do about the next album? You know, we were ready to get in the studio and smash it out again and start the process again. And they were kind of like, we'll talk about it in a couple of months or whatever, you know, and we're like, what do we do now? You know, like, and our lawyers said, you know, their option's up in a couple of weeks. So if they don't say anything, you can legally walk away. And so we sort of waited up amongst ourselves, and we felt like we were, you know, we deserved probably a bit more attention, and we needed to know what we were going to do rather than just be in limbo. And the date rolled around, and they rang up and said the band has left the building, you know. And we did get offered a couple of other deals afterwards, but they weren't good ones because we'd sort of learnt a lot as well. So that's why we thought we'll just keep plugging away and doing it ourselves. And that's, I guess, where we just sort of had the taste of money and then back to the taste of poverty kind of shows you true ilk in what you do, you know.
But who are you touring with around this time?
We didn't really tour with many Roadrunner bands because we played with NIL, but we didn't tour with them. And we played with Effigy maybe once or twice. I can't remember. But Roadrunner Australia did this other side label called Dark Carnival. I think I sent you that Dreadnought.
Yeah.
So we did a couple of big tours with Dreadnought around the country, which were great. Like, they're real metal compared to us. But we do that thing where if we're playing with a metal band, I think we get subconsciously heavier, and like we kind of, you know, we moved around with who we were playing with. We did a lot of the big Big Day Out tours. So we played, the Big Day Out that we played in Adelaide, I remember looking at the schedule, and we were playing on one of the smaller side stages, but at the same time Coldplay were playing the main stage, and they'd just broken, like, that, you know, that first Coldplay album when it exploded, it was like huge. And I just remember going, no one is going to be watching us today. Like, everyone is going to be over there. We walked on stage and there was just thousands of people there to watch us. And I was just like, oh, my God, you know, and we killed it. It was a great show. We played with anyone and everyone, and like, but we didn't really have a scene, I don't think. Like, we weren't like comrades with other bands. We used to tour with this band Lotel quite a bit. They had a couple of big songs. One was called Teenager of the Year, but they were through a bigger label, through Sony, and they liked us, and we used to just go on tour with them and drink all their beer and go and party in their better hotel rooms. But we weren't compatible at all. Like, it was just, I don't think we really had a scene that we felt comfortable in, so we just went anywhere we wanted and just sort of forced our way in, you know?
Looking back, do you think that maybe you should have created more of a niche for yourself in a scene, like kind of established a more consistent sound?
Yeah, maybe, but we just didn't really know what we were doing, so we just did it for ourselves. Like, we were sort of selfish in the sense that if we liked it, we figured it was good. But and I guess it's a good way to be, like, because ultimately, you know, the success or failure comes down to you, where if the record company ever tried to sort of shape us, like, there was a couple of times, you know, I remember, you know, maybe you should do something a bit more like this Silverchair thing. And we're like, yeah, but people can tell when you're copying someone, or, you know, you're too heavily influenced by someone. So, you know, as much as we could sound like Silverchair, I don't think anyone would buy it, because they'd go, these idiots sound like Silverchair. So we were always very headstrong in our, this is our sound, and if people dig it, that's great, and if they don't, that's cool too. But we definitely stuck to our guns, pardon the pun. Like, we were very, this is the way we're doing things, you know. We didn't, not that they were overly, they never tried to steer us in a direction that we didn't feel comfortable in, but we were always very much, you signed us because we sound like this, just let us do our thing kind of thing.
Well, I'm interested to hear that they tried to get you to do anything, because it seemed like with NIL, they just like were like, oh, we signed you, and, you know, we'll be back in a little while and you can give us the album.
Yeah, no, I heard Andy's episode. John was definitely a bit more hands-on with us. Like, we used to have a lot of meetings, and he did come to the studio when we were recording. Not he never, you know, said, play it this way or more of this, but they definitely, like, Bob and John definitely were hands-on in our business affairs, and they were great. Like, you know, we had a really good time with Roadrunner, and when we left, it was a hard decision, because I would have loved to have, if we went to that meeting and they said, let's get started on this next album, bigger, better, more, you know, I would have been so thrilled. But it was just the, oh, we'll see what happens. And we'd already sort of gone to that point of no return that we couldn't just sit around treading water.
I know that you said you were familiar, of course, with Roadrunner, but were there bands on the label that you were a fan of that you...
Yeah, I was just thinking about this before. Like, I remember one night I was watching Rage, which is a film clip show like MTV, but it was like it used to start at like midnight and go till through 6 in the morning. So you'd get home from a gig and you'd be drunk and you'd sit in front of the TV and put Rage on. And I was living with the guys from The Egg, so Simon, the drummer in Elephant Gun, and a few other friends from the band, Jim and Colin, and we were watching Rage, and Life of Agony's River Runs Red, which what was the one with the...
Through and Through?
Yeah. That came on, and I remember just like going, what is this? And like got up hungover first thing in the morning, caught a tram to the city and bought the album and just thrashed the absolute hell out of it. Like, it was such a game changer for me. I just love that album. You know, all the Sepultura stuff. We used to listen to a lot of King Diamond and all that early stuff back in boarding school, when I used to go to boarding school. There was all, because everyone used to have their own beat boxes with tapes and stuff. So, and I really liked the Life of Agony Weeds album. That was kind of like a different direction, and I don't think it really probably did what they were hoping it would do, but I thought it was a great album.
Soul Searching Sun?
That one, yeah. I just dug it. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, that was an interesting time for them, because they, like, you know, basically kind of broke up pretty much immediately upon it being released. And then Whitfield Crane from Ugly Kid Joe became the singer.
And I had no idea about that.
Yeah, so like they put out that album and Keith Mina Caputo quit. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, Whitfield Crane. Do you know who Ugly Kid Joe is?
I do, yeah.
Okay, so imagine Whitfield, that guy singing.
He's like, does some stuff in Melbourne with a guy. I can't remember what they're called. But yeah, he spends a lot of time in Australia.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and did they record anything with him, or is there any?
No, so they did those live shows with him, and then they decided that they were going to continue on with a different vocalist, this guy Eric Rogers. Mm. But then the bass player, Alan Roberts, quit, and he kind of wrote all the songs. Right. So then they became this other band called Stereo Mud was like kind of like a nu metal band, but really not. I mean, in all reality, if you don't know what nu metal is and you heard it, you'd be like, yeah, this sounds like Life of Agony with a different singer. Mm. But if you do know what nu metal is, you'd be like, oh, that sounds like Seven Dust or something.
Yeah. Oh, but I do remember that album really, like the River Runs Red. Like, there's very few times when I've seen or heard something and run to the store to buy it. And that was one of the times, you know, and it was a big moment for me, because it was like, it's metal, but he's got this voice, and they do that real dirgy stuff, and then they go real fast, and it was just like, wow, this is cool.
So you went to boarding school?
Yes. My dad was in the military, and we moved all over the place, like, yeah, through the Pacific, like Papua New Guinea and Fiji and stuff. And he'd been to boarding school, and he always used to threaten me with, one day you're going to go to boarding school. And then so sure enough, like, I was doing really bad at this international school in New Guinea, and I think they were going to expel me. And I was like, I think it's time for me to go to boarding school, you know, just rather than sort of get pushed off, I jumped off, you know. And it was interesting because it was almost a bit Lord of the Flies, you know. You got 60 kids sort of basically looking after themselves with a couple of housemasters and whatnot walking around. They just couldn't, you know, it was very crazy. But music-wise, it was like that's where I really cut my teeth with rock and roll, and like just hearing stuff that you'd never heard before from somebody else going, come and listen to this. And you go into their room and that, you know, it was like a real camaraderie of getting exposed to cool music. And if you threw down with, you got to check this out, and it was weak, like you just get, you're not getting the stereo anymore. You know what I mean? It's like if you played something that blew people's minds, you'd be like world champion, you know. And if you put something on that people go, this is so crap, it was like the ultimate disgrace, you know.
No, I feel like that's a very coming of age thing that happened back in the 90s and 2000s, where maybe even not, I feel like boarding school is very unique, but like a sleepaway camp or something like that is really like where you would meet people that you normally wouldn't meet and have conversations with them on a regular basis, because versus just seeing somebody at a show or the mall or whatever. And I really do think that was a big part of being younger and kind of finding out about new bands. And it's funny because it was kind of that trial by fire thing too, where it's like, oh, what do you like? Well, we're not listening to that crap anymore. You're going to like punk rock now, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you try and put something like one of those kind of glam rock bands. Like, I remember I used to listen to this band. Oh, what are they called? Like Circus of Power. Do you remember them? The 80s?
No, but I already like it with circus involved.
And, you know, like that'd be one of my, like if I want to impress somebody that hadn't heard something, I'd be like, check this out. You know, you put on Circus of Power. But I did just remember that first Queens of the Stone Age album that came out through Loose Groove, which I think is Stone Gossard from Pearl Jam's label, but it came out through Roadrunner, I think, in some countries.
It did, yeah.
That was one that blew my mind when it came out. Like, that first Queens album just does not get enough kudos, in my opinion. It's like, it's probably my favorite Queens album. It's so good. And I remember going many times to the dudes at Roadrunner, why isn't this exploding? It's like Caius, who are massive. Why, you know, what's going on? And I saw at a festival we were playing at, I can't remember if we were playing or I was working with somebody or I don't know, but Josh Homme was there. And I thought, I'll stroll up and start a conversation. I'd sort of met him once or twice before, but not that he'd remember. And I was like doing the old, they'd already sort of gotten bigger. I think it was like around Rated R. But I was like chatting with him. I did the old, oh, we're kind of label mates in a way. And he's like, oh, how's that? And I'm like, oh, my band's through Roadrunner. And he goes, oh, man, I'm sorry to hear that. And just like walked off. And I'm like, not how I was planning on that going.
The famous story is that they were like, yeah, we think you're cool. We like the songs, but you got to get a different singer. And he's like, no, I'm going to sing. And they're like, well, nobody's ever going to listen to a band with you singing. You sound. And then some people did.
Yeah.
A couple million people decided to check it out. You talk to different people and different songs on here are their favorite, you know, but what was there like a song that you consistently, it was like the set closer, like you guys felt like was your strongest song?
Well, Cataract, which was the first single off Albino, is our most played song. Like when you see all the data come through from the streaming services and all that, and you know, when people talk about it and when it came out on radio, there's this local national network called Triple J, which is like the youth radio. It's sort of like through the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Commission. And back in the day, if you got a song on Triple J, it meant that you could go to and play, because if somebody heard it in, you know, wherever, it meant that there was at least one kid that was going to turn up to the show, because it had a really massive reach. When Cataract came out and Bob took it to Triple J, like, I can't remember who was running the show at the time, but they loved it. They were like, this is great. And I remember I was working in a friend's warehouse, and one day I heard it like six times on the radio. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to quit my job again, you know. sure enough, I didn't have to quit my job. Because it turns out that even though they played it six times in a day, like, didn't equate to any sales or anything. But it did mean that people started coming to the shows and people were interested. And it definitely is a song that people recognised for a while. We still play it live, even though, you know, it's doesn't really fit in with the stuff we're playing at the moment, but it is a good song. I mean, it's one of those songs that sort of, you know, people identify with. Then the second single off Albino was the Profit Margin, which I just thought was not a good idea. Like, it's just, it's not rocky enough. It's a bit too melodic, ballady. I think we should have gone more heavy for the second single rather than more light. And that was kind of, it went Cataract, oh, Profit Margin, oh, you know, it was just, it was a bit of an anti-climax when you're hoping. If the first single trajectory had continued with a second single, I think it would have been a different state of play. But it was definitely like a plane's engine going off and started plummeting towards the earth.
What about around the time where the EP is coming out? What's like the, is it SEM?
Yeah, SEM and Monster, I think. SEM was definitely... It was sort of the most straight up kind of rock and roll song. And I think because we weren't metal, Roadrunner was kind of hoping that we'd be the kind of band that would infiltrate the mainstream radio a bit more than, you know, this is way before the Nickelbacks kicked off and all that jazz. But I think they were hoping that we could kind of bridge that gap of being alternative, cool, but mainstream, acceptable kind of thing, you know, which is, you can't kind of plan those things. They either happen or they don't. I think when you try and, you know, please everyone, you can very quickly please no one. So SEM, I think it's a really good straight up and down rock song, you know. And it's Todd wrote the lyrics. It's about I love my American football, as you know, your Panthers. How are they doing at the moment?
The Panthers didn't exist. We didn't. The Panthers, you know, come in the 90s. So yeah, our local team at the time was the Falcons. And then when the Panthers came, there was this guy named Kevin Green on the Panthers. Yeah, yeah. And he was in World Championship Wrestling. So I was like, okay, I think the Panthers are cool. And then Cam Newton came and, you know, we got beef. And
but yeah, you guys have sorted it out now, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Boogie has sorted it out with me. But
yeah, back to the original story. The SEM lyrics are about, we've got Australian football over here, AFL, and it's about a football team that got disbanded. You know, they shut it down and merged it with another team. You know, they sort of do that in sports. And the team was like 120 years old. And so Todd wrote this song about this team getting basically shafted. And the SEM thing came from, it was the first time we actually spent somebody else's money on music. So SEM stands for somebody else's money.
Well, your team should be the Redskins with that Indian Giver name that you were going back.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the Indian Giver thing was weird because, I mean, we didn't really, I mean, we cared in the sense that we needed a good name, and Elephant Gun was, you know, I love that name. But yeah, in Australia, the Indian Giver term was basically, you know, if you called somebody an Indian Giver, it's because they'd basically done something dodgy, given you something and then taken it back off you. And we didn't really think about the implications internationally. So when they said, look, it's probably not going to fly, we were like, yeah, cool. You know, we don't want to upset anyone. The interesting thing was we did this four-track demo on cassette. This is sort of before the Roadrunner, like, before we'd started doing the live gigs, we had a friend with a four-track Tascam recorder, and the first the first cassette demo has instruct, like, it was this thing we saw that we pinched off a toilet, but it was like how to use a toilet. So there's someone sitting on a toilet like a stick figure, and then somebody squatting next to a toilet and we're like with a big cross through it, and it just said Indian giver above it. And that was our, you know, first demo that we used to pass out to friends and family and whatnot. And I was like, when they saw that, like, oh, you're gonna have to change Indian giver. I'm like, what, the toilet thing doesn't upset you? Yeah.
Well, that should have been the cover of this, but instead you got this big big bug going on. So can you tell me how that relates to Elephant Gun?
We didn't really think about, I mean, no, that's not true. We thought about the artwork a lot, but we were very much into sort of simplistic imagery. Like, that one was an idea that we got from, I don't know, something small magnified we thought was kind of a cool option, you know, cool place to start. And so there's this government thing called the CSIRO here, which is like a science, you know, government sciences. And so we contacted them and we went in and looked at all these slides of microscopic photos of bugs and stuff. And that one just kind of appealed to us. And then we just, yeah, we didn't really kind of go, this is the theme or whatever. We just, if it looked cool, we just liked it, you know. And that's just like with the glass of milk thing on the albino, people are like, what does that mean? I'm like, no idea. We've come up with clever stuff since, you know. We're like, there was the Andy Warhol kind of simplistic, you know, can of soup thing. And I read this article recently that there's, you know, in like Clockwork Orange and No Country for Old Men, like, villains always drink glasses of milk. And I sent it to the guys at the band. I was like, see, that was what we meant, but we had no idea at the time. Now that we, you know, come full circle, it's about evil dudes drinking glasses of milk.
Well, I know you don't have a lot of regrets on the time with Roadrunner with Elephant Gun, and you're very grateful for your time with it. Yeah. But at the same time, is there something that looking back on and with the knowledge you have now, because you were so new back then, that you would have done differently, or you wish you would have known back then to do?
I wouldn't have quit my job every time I heard my song on the radio. Look, I mean, I think because we're still friends as a band and we still do stuff, like, I don't know if you've had to listen to that new album that we did, but, like, to me, that we released, like, this thing called Now to Survive Out, or through a friend's indie label in 2020, and it got just some great reviews, and it sort of reinvigorated a lot of people's interest in the band, and it sort of has made us closer as a band, and we're doing these shows and stuff. So I just think to have that longevity of, you know, what is it, 20-something years doing the same thing, not all the time. We take time off and do hiatus. It's not like we get together every day and go, must rehearse just in case we become the next Stones, you know. But I think just the fact that the friendships of the band, you know, have lasted, and we still love each other and love doing it together, makes it hard to have any regrets, because it's still a cool thing for us, you know. We don't, yeah, I mean, there'd probably be things that I'd do or we'd do differently through hindsight, but very happy with what we achieved, you know, considering we signed a deal after three shows. You know, some bands don't even get to do three shows, you know.
That's so true.
I'm really happy with our legacy. Not that it's, you know, changed the world, but it's like, yeah, I listen to it and I still enjoy it, which is great.
Thanks so much to Sean for taking us back to 1998 discussing this record. But back to the future, in 2020, the band did release a new album called Now to Survive, which is available on all streaming platforms and still sporadically plays shows here and there. So if you're in Australia, definitely check them out. And also, if you're in Australia, take me with you. If you're hearing my voice right now, this is the Meet Me Podcast, and you can go to our patreon.com/meetmepod. You could have heard this episode early. You can tell me on there what episodes you'd wish I'd do, as long as it's not somebody from New York. And you can also tell me that on Instagram, @meetmepod. Post a story, send a message, leave a comment, whatever you want to do to communicate with me your needs and desires. I would love to think about them. In the meantime, my name is Ryan Rainbow. This is Meep Meep, and yes, that's the best that I could come up with. Bye!